From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Immigration reform, the debate begins. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Senators on both sides of the aisle were lined up with amendments today on a measure that divides both Republicans and Democrats. There are bitter differences over border security, the need for workers, and whether jobs should be saved for those born in this country. Democrats want to cement their hold on Hispanic voters. Some Republicans want to woo them away. But is the path to citizenship really amnesty? We'll hear about the opening act of a drama that's taken decades to reach the political stage, and we'll look at the possible outcomes. On Reporter's Notebook later on, a live report from Istanbul, Turkey. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. Senate made history of a kind yesterday by agreeing to a full debate on immigration reform. That hasn't happened in decades, despite a consensus that the current system is an ongoing disaster. The amendment process is already underway. We'll hear about today's action and the obstacle course that lies ahead. On Reporter's Notebook, last night, Turkish police drove protesters out of Istanbul's Taksim Square, but a crowd is growing again. We'll get a report from there. First, this news update. Two wildfires are out of control in Colorado. Thousands of people have fled from their homes. Dozens of houses have burned to the ground as the Black Forest Fire wreaks havoc near Colorado Springs. Curtis Lee is there for the Denver Post. And Curtis, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Warren.
How many homes have been lost?
So there's been estimates of 80 to 100 homes have burned in the first day of the fire. The fire began yesterday. The initial 911 calls began to flood in yesterday around 1 p.m. And, you know, in this first 24 hours, there's reports of 80 to 100 homes that have been lost so far.
What about the human cost? Have there been casualties?
There have been no reports of injuries to firefighters or residents or reported casualties. Though the El Paso County Sheriff, that's the sheriff here in Colorado Springs, did note this morning that, you know, a number of people did not evacuate from this fire zone and that he is concerned there will be fatalities involved with this. Though they did not set a number, though they haven't been able to get in there to check things. But it should be noted that the sheriff's office did say there have been no missing persons reports. So family members haven't reported a loved one missing, which is good news, essentially. But he still is on the cautious. He's very cautious about this, and he's concerned there could be fatalities involved with this fire.
How close are you to the fire now?
I'm about 5 miles away from the fire. I'm in North Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs is about 70 miles south of the capital city of Denver here in Colorado along the Front Range. And the fire's taking place in northwest Colorado Springs. I'm in North Colorado Springs, but I can look over on the horizon, see the plume of smoke. It's very hazy here. You can smell the smoke throughout the city. It's just very hot, very dry. It's not ideal temperatures at all to be fighting a wildfire.
Are there other characteristics about this fire that make it difficult? Is it spotty, for example, popping up in different places? I know that often happens.
Well, yeah, the details of the fire, I mean, it was very hot overnight. Usually, that's what the El Paso County Sheriff said today. I mean, usually fires kind of tend to cool down at night when the temperatures drop. The sheriff noted this morning that this fire was very hot at 5 a.m. this morning still. And, I mean, he was hearing propane explosions and just gas explosions throughout the different subdivisions and neighborhoods back in Black Forest. And, I mean, it's a tough fire. And they have aerial support. The federal government is coming in with air tankers, these MAF planes, these kind of C-170 air tankers that are out of Peterson Air Force Base here in Colorado Springs are beginning to fly over the burn area and dumping, retardant on the burn area. So they're just trying to fight this with manpower on the ground as well as aerial support.
How does this compare to other fires that you've covered in Colorado?
This is very interesting that you ask that. I mean, less than a year ago, it's almost a year ago to the the day of Waldo Canyon fire occurred here in Colorado Springs, and that happened less than 20 miles away from where this Black Forest fire is occurring. I mean, that fire, the Waldo Canyon fire, happened on the west side of the city. This is kind of in the northeast side, I should say. I'm sorry, I said earlier the fire's in the northwest part. It's actually the northeast side. So, I mean, it's very close together. Waldo Canyon, 350 homes were destructed. Obviously, there's 80 to 100 in this fire. There are two casualties in Waldo Canyon. They haven't reported casualties yet. In this fire, so it's just very eerie that these fires have occurred, you know, less than a year ago to the day, almost in this community.
And despite that history, people apparently are not all responding to the call to evacuate.
Yeah, and that's surprising. I mean, a lot of people, you know, just want to remain with their homes and want to try and protect their homes, and they're not heeding the advice to evacuate. And then that's obviously a difficult situation that firefighters as well as law enforcement have to deal with.
Are there fire hydrants in a place like this?
That's interesting. I have not been back in that subdivision in Black Forest. I'm not sure if there's fire hydrants. I know that where Waldo Canyon, where that occurred, it was very much a residential. Houses were very close together. There were fire hydrants on the corners, which obviously helped, you know, firefighters fight that blaze. But in this subdivision, I'm not sure. It's very, very wooded area where Black Forest is. Very, you know, wild grass, large pine trees. Just very dry. We had a wet spring. Snow went into, you know, late April here in Colorado, but it's been very dry the month of May, very dry into June, and it's just, you know, it's horrible conditions for a wildfire, and it's the prime conditions for a wildfire to start.
Does it feel pretty hot to you now?
Oh, it's extremely hot. I think it's going to get up into the mid to high 90s today for the third or fourth day in a row.
All right. Curtis Lee, again, the Black Forest fire in Colorado, just in Colorado Springs, just yes. One of several fires going on across the state. On the other side of the state, apparently, a prison had to be evacuated because of a fire. Curtis Lee, it's good to talk with you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Again, reporter with the Denver Post. In a moment, the debate begins on immigration reform on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Worman Olney back with To the Point. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate voted 82-15 to let immigration reform come to the floor. It's the first time that's happened in decades. The vote was overwhelming, but nobody thinks it guarantees passage, and some opponents are pushing what supporters call poison pills. Fawn Johnson is covering today's opening moves for the National Journal. Fawn Johnson, good to have you back on our program.
Happy to be here.
What are the moves look like today?
Well, they're doing a lot of posturing, and there's not a lot of action right now. The vote yesterday was a vote to just go ahead and begin debating the bill. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has said that he will have a final vote on the bill before the July 4th recess, so that gives them about 2.5 weeks to spend time talking on the floor. But there's a lot of back and forth about which amendments they're actually going to bring up and vote on, and in what order that will happen. It's kind of like a little Senate game that happens, but a lot of what it does is it will gauge people's support as the process goes along. And this is a sensitive enough bill that there are a lot of members of the Senate who don't want to tip their hand until the very last minute. So that last vote that they're going to have right before the July 4th recess will be very dramatic. And up until then, they're going to be spending a lot of time figuring out what they can talk about, when, and how they can make it, you know, push the bill in one direction or another.
This is the bill proposed by the so-called Gang of Eight to members of both parties involved. Tell us what the major features of it are.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty simple concept, really. It's a bill that would give legal status to about 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country now. They would spend about 10 years on a provisional status and then eventually would convert to a green card, which would allow them to become citizens 5 years later. That's the central piece of the bill, and that's the thing that without that, there's going to be no Democratic support. It also creates a couple of new visa programs to allow people to come here legally to, in theory, prevent the illegal population from building up again. And it has a lot of enforcement and border security provisions. And that is one of the areas that Republicans are trying to bolster even more. So, for example, Senator John Cornyn of Texas has proposed 10,000 border agents as opposed to the 3,500 that was in the original Senate gang bill. This is the kind of back and forth that we'll be seeing over the next couple of weeks.
Let me just play for our listeners a very brief comment by Senator Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, and then I'll ask you if this is typical of the kind of thing that we're hearing today.
Some have suggested that by pointing out the flaws in the bill, we're letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. That vastly understates the problems in this bill. Far from good, this bill repeats the mistakes of the past. It makes our immigration system worse than the one we have today, and will only lead to bigger and less manageable problems in the future.
Back to Fawn Johnson with the National Journal. When he talks about mistakes of the past, is he talking about the last immigration reform bill in 1986?
Yeah, the people sometimes forget that there was actually an enforcement-only immigration bill that passed in the mid-90s, but the 1986 bill is the one that opponents like Mike Lee continue to go back to and talk about, because the 1986 bill did, in fact, give amnesty to about 3 million undocumented immigrants, and it did not provide a way for people to come here who are from foreign countries to work after the fact. So there are people who believe that just by creating that amnesty, you are inviting more people to come in because you can expect them to do another one later. But the other thing to note is that we hear this particular argument about this immigration bill a lot, about the 1986 bill, in making comparisons. It's important to look at who is saying it. Mike Lee is going to vote no on this bill no matter what. But the other thing to remember is that the current legislation that they're debating is actually a much fuller legislation than the 1986 bill, which was really meant it wasn't meant to completely overhaul immigration policy. It was intended to tweak some of the problems that they saw. So they said, okay, we'll give this group of immigrants some legal status, and we're also going to create a new system that employers can verify the legal status of their workers. But it wasn't this massive overhaul that we're looking at now.
So you said this is more comprehensive than 1986, and in particular with regard to what you referred to as two new visa programs,
right,
to allow people to come in legally. These are people, high-skilled people on the one hand, and agricultural workers on the other?
There's a new agricultural visa for people who are here illegally already, but actually there's one totally new visa program, which would be for low-skilled workers generally. So this is not necessarily ag, or there's also, under current law, there's some visas for people who come for seasonal work, like working at a ski lodge or in the crabbing season or something like that. So the new low-skill work visa program is intended to answer the critics of the 1986 law, who say that the reason why we have a current population of 11 million undocumented is because they didn't have such a low-skill visa that they could take advantage of in the past. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether or not that would actually work and whether there would still be a black market of labor. There's also a lot of debate about whether the security is enough to keep these people out. But the idea for this new visa program is that it would answer that particular critique about the 1986 bill.
What does this bill say about verification of people's status when they apply for work?
It's a new program that under current law we have the I-9, which I'm sure everyone who is listening has probably filled one of those out. It's a paper form that you fill out to certify who you are when you get a job. The bill is looking to make that program electronic, meaning that you can go into a database, automatically check against the Social Security Administration's number and name to verify that you are who you say you are. It's already in place on a voluntary basis, and there are lots and lots of employers who use it now, but it would make it mandatory. And that would be a big change for business, and it would also be a big change for employees who are switching jobs a lot, especially if they have some sort of strange strangeness in their name. This happens a lot with foreign nationals, or if there's a misplacement of their Social Security numbers. But the idea is that it's supposed to make it very clear to the employer almost immediately that this person who I want to hire is here legally. And it's a long time coming. I mean, it's certainly something that everybody is ready and willing to adopt. But again, there's a lot of concern in the employer community that it won't work particularly well because it's a government program and it's big databases and it costs money.
As we go forward, we're going to be talking about border security, no doubt. And I take it that border security is one of the areas where Senator Reid, the Democrat who leads the Senate, says that Republicans have poison pills involved.
Absolutely. And particularly the person who is leading the fight, I would argue, most arduously on, and effectively on border security is, again, John Cornyn from Texas. He has an amendment that the reason why Senator Reid says it's a poison pill is that it would make the citizenship eligibility contingent on the Border Patrol reaching certain benchmarks. And for Democrats, that is just a non-starter, that they don't want to see citizenship being held hostage by, events at the border that they can't control or by the inability of the Border Patrol to do their jobs because of lack of funding. So that's why they say the Senator Reid and Democrats say it's a poison pill. Senator Cornyn would like to see something like this put into the bill because many Republicans are skeptical that the promises of border security are not going to be followed through with. And they point again to the 1986 bill and they say there was a lot in there that was promised that President Reagan did not follow through on. So it's a back and forth. I'm guessing it'll come out somewhere in the middle. You know, they might add a little bit to the border, but I don't think that the Democrats are going to allow a really hard contingency plan on citizenship.
All right. You've gotten us off to a great start. Fawn Johnson, covering immigration for the National Journal and very particularly the Senate debate that is going on as we speak. Thanks so much for being on our program.
It's a pleasure.
Here is a comment made yesterday when they were debating whether to debate by Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, Republican, of course, one of those considered to be a potential presidential candidate. And because he is himself a Latino, very important to this conversation.
I refuse to accept the idea that the most powerful country on earth, the nation that put a man on the moon, is incapable of securing its own border. Our sovereignty is at stake in terms of border security. Border security is not an anti-immigration or an anti-immigrant measure. It is an important national security measure, but it is also an important defense of our sovereignty. And we must protect our borders.
Again, Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida. Ruben Navarrete Jr. is a CNN contributor, nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be back with you, Warren.
How important is this issue of border security? We heard it mentioned a bit by Fawn Johnson and the idea of setting up some sort of benchmarks. Is there an effort to set up, by Republicans particularly, to set up benchmarks that would really be unrealistic and demand that there be 100% border control, whatever that might mean?
Right, there's a lot to say about this. First of all, you know, I'm glad to see Harry Reid finally mention the phrase poison pill because, you know, for the last 7 or 8 years or so when we've had this conversation, the poison pills have come from his side of the fence. Poison pills that Democrats have put into bills to do away with, like the Byron Doran Amendment, for instance, in 2007, to do away with guest workers. So both parties have used poison pills to scare off the other side. It's refreshing to see Reid use the term. Border security, though, has more value really in rhetoric and in symbolism than in reality. I'm speaking to you from San Diego. I've covered the immigration issue from Arizona to in Texas as well. I know my way around the border. And you're never going to secure that border. I hate to be the one to tell you guys this, but you're never going to secure a 2,000-mile border where parts of the border are underwater in the Rio Grande and parts of the border go through, you know, the University of Brownsville and parts of the border go through private land. You're never going to be able to secure the border in Washington where people have the luxury of not really understanding the immigration issue. There are people in Washington who have strong opinions about immigration, but they don't understand the issue because they live so far from the border. You can tell yourself that you can secure the border, and people like Marco Rubio and more so John Cornyn use that to their advantage. But it's really a misnomer to think you're ever going to control that border.
Are you yourself in favor of this bill?
I am in favor of this bill as an alternative to doing nothing. And here's why. Because there are people in this country, you're not going to get under this bill, no matter what the left promises, citizenship or even legal status for all 11 million, because the disqualifiers in there of criminal record and learning English and the like, you're going to take a lot of those 11 million out. So ultimately, we'll probably have a debate about 3 or 4 million people at most getting some sort of benefit. To my mind, that's still half a loaf, because there are people out there who are suffering, have been suffering for a long time, and they need some sort of legal status to go forward with their lives and their children's lives. It is not a perfect bill. It will not solve the problem, because it doesn't deal with this as an economic issue. It's over 1,000 pages. It's laden with pork. It's probably going to collapse under its own weight. It's always a possibility. So it's not a perfect bill. I think it could be made better, but I'll take it because it's better than nothing.
Let me introduce Jerry Kammer. He's a senior research fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. So Jerry Kammer, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back.
How do you feel about this bill?
Well, I think there's a lot to like in the bill, and I think that the bill is essentially promising to do what the 1986 Act promised to do and so notoriously failed to do. So to the extent that the bill can meet its own goals of legalizing those who are now here illegally and taking steps to avoid another wave of illegal immigration, something that is constantly invoked by the Gang of Eight, I think that would be a really good thing for the country. I am a bit skeptical that worksite enforcement is going to be credible and will be followed up on. I don't know if you want to get into that or not, but
this would be what we talked about earlier, the e-verification program that would be electronic that we talked about with Fawn Johnson.
That's correct. I think that there are many who are concerned that that program could be evaded or avoided or tricked, and others who think that there just will not be the administrative political commitment to follow through on it. I think it's interesting to note that there is a left-right coalition of civil liberties groups, libertarians, and people who are ideologically committed to small government who don't like the idea of the government telling people under what circumstances they're to hire employees. And that coalition is always in the background, always has its knife sharp and ready for battle. And we will, I think, see them deployed at some point if this bill goes through. And that will be a real test for people like Senator Schumer, who is, I think, the real intellectual force behind this bill, and who should be aware of the vulnerability of immigration legislation to fraud, because it was he who, back in 1986, put together a proposal to provide amnesty to farm workers that was itself subject to enormous fraud, as has been well documented.
Ruben Navarrete, back to you, our columnist of the Washington Post Writers Group, a CNN a contributor. Interested in your take both on the workplace enforcement issue. Is it, in fact, full of holes? Could it be subject to a fraud, first of all?
Yes, absolutely. Here's the thing about E-Verify. And I've had this argument with the chief proponent of E-Verify, Lamar Smith, the congressman from San Antonio, as well. 70%, 70-80% of illegal immigrants in the United States are hired by the domestic household, by American households, nannies, gardeners, housekeepers. That's where the money is, so to speak. Those households are exempt from participating in E-Verify. So you're never at E-Verify, you're always going to be nibbling around the edges, because you're only going to be talking about private employers. You're never going to talk about making a soccer mom check the legal status of their nanny. And so that's the main, I think, indictment against E-Verify, the fact that it's really more smoke and less substance.
All right. I'm going to interrupt you in the interest of time. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll talk with Doris Meisner, who is former director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program, or is director now at the Migration Policy Institute. She was once head of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll hear from Istanbul, where Prime Minister Erdogan and protesters are trying to guess each other's moves. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Onley back with To the Point, talking today about the immigration bill, which has now reached the floor of the Senate for the first time in decades, an issue that everybody agrees needs to be dealt with because the system is broken. And now there may be a chance for this one to pass. We're talking about the Senate, where it will begin. No telling as yet what might happen in the House. Doris Meisner, again, is a senior fellow and director of the U.S. Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute. That's a nonprofit that studies immigration and border issues. She was commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service during the 1990s. Ms. Meisner, good to have you back on our program.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Let's talk about the border security issue. How secure is the border now? The president says that it's never been as secure as it is. He says that, and he has, in fact, been responsible for more deportations of undocumented people than any other president.
Well, those are very important points. The border is more secure than it ever has been, and it's more secure than it ever has been because as a country, both Democrats and Republicans in the Congress and in the White House have invested heavily in the border. Over the last at least 20 years, we've poured enormous resources into the border, and those additional Border Patrol agents and very large infusions of technology, fencing, et cetera, are making a difference. Now, they're not able to make a difference on their own, but there is a combination of things now that has happened in recent years that make the border situation be very different from what it had been for the last 30 or 40 years. It's not only the enforcement on the border, it's also, of course, the aftermath of the recession and the fact that there is less job demand in the United States for people coming here illegally. It's also that the largest source of illegal immigration has been Mexico, and circumstances in Mexico have changed dramatically. We're seeing a much lower birth rate and fertility rate in Mexico. Their age curve is maturing so that there are less young people coming into the labor market that can't find jobs. There's good growth in Mexico, growth of a middle class. So there are some real structural changes, both in terms of U.S. capability in enforcement to have effective border enforcement and changes in the push factors and the pull factors for illegal immigration. It's a different picture than it was in 1986, an entirely different picture.
The situation in Mexico has changed in the ways that you described. What about Central America? Aren't there a lot of people from Guatemala, Nicaragua, Honduras, and other countries in Central America that want to come here?
Yes, there are. And those people, of course, come largely through Mexico. That is the one part of the illegal flow on the Mexican border that has been inching upward. Those countries have a different demographic picture. But at the end of the day, those countries are much smaller than Mexico is. And if we enact immigration reform that allows for continuing strengthening of border enforcement, but also allows for legal ways for people to get to the country where there are jobs and is discouraging in terms of the workplace and the ability of American employers to easily hire, that combination, that reconfiguration of the incentives should make a difference. Now, it is the case that you're never going to have perfection on the southwest border. Any enforcement dilemma or any problem where you throw only enforcement at it to solve it isn't going to entirely be 100%, and that's, of course, what's so difficult about what Senator Cornyn is arguing, that somehow or another we should have an airtight border. Of course, we're not going to have an entirely 100% enforced border, but we don't ask that of law enforcement anywhere. We don't ask that in our big cities. We don't ask that of any of our regulatory functions. What we ask is that these problems be properly managed, that there be strong deterrence, that there be professional enforcement in place, and where the southwest border is concerned, the work that is being done in enforcement, if it can be combined with some of these other reforms, should allow us to be able to manage this issue.
Let me go back to Ruben Navarrete, our nationally syndicated columnist, Washington Post Writers Group, a CNN contributor. Earlier, we heard Senator Rubio of Florida saying very strongly that we are not incapable of securing our own border, the nation that can send somebody to the moon. What's the if it's as obvious as you and Ms. Meisner have pointed out that you can't have 100% control of the border, where does this all come from, and why is Senator Rubio particularly making that point?
Well, let me say, first of all, that's easy to say when you live in Florida. When you live in Florida and you don't know much about the Mexican border, it's easy to say we can secure that border. But in the reality of the border is, again, you go down and talk to the experts. Talk to the guys in the green shirts with the guns and the badges, the border patrolmen. They'll tell you that no matter how high a fence you build or how many even border patrol agents you hire to put into the union, you're never going to be able to stop a hungry family from crossing or a provider from crossing to feed their family.
So you think that Senator Rubio is just making a mistake then? This isn't a strategic move?
It's worse than that. It's politics. He's trying to offer a fig leaf to those moderate Republicans who are out there. There are people like Jeff Sessions and Ted Cruz who are never going to vote for this bill, but there are moderate Republicans who may. And all they need is to be told, reassurance that they will not be dealing with a future wave and we can secure the border. So Rubio is telling them what they want to hear, but it's not based in fact.
Jory Kammer, back to you with the Center for Immigration Studies. Do you agree that this is a fig leaf, not a real issue?
No, I think it's an issue, but I think it's an exaggerated issue. I do think that Senator Rubio and a lot of other of our political leaders are very comfortable talking about getting tough at the border and putting money into border resources, and much less comfortable talking about a credible worksite enforcement regime, because when you do the border enforcement, you can placate a lot of powerful constituents who are part of what's been called the border industrial complex, whereas if you cut off the availability of low-wage labor to a lot of employers who enjoy hiring folks who are not authorized to be in the country, you antagonize them. So I really think that the test of fire for this legislation and for credibility in immigration enforcement is going to be at the worksite.
At the worksite, where obviously employers want to see this happening. Has this divided the Republicans pretty definitely?
I think without a doubt, especially in the aftermath of the November election, which was an enormous shock and which really got Lindsey Graham on the phone to Chuck Schumer to say, hey, let's talk and see if we can work this out. And Senator McCain has been very frank in saying, in response to a question, why are you taking this up again? He said, well, I'll give you some straight talk. It's votes. It's election. So Republicans realize that they're in a demographic box, and many of them are very eager to find a way out of it.
You mentioned the November election. The reelection, of course, of President Obama was said to depend, at least in part, on the vote of Hispanics. And yet he hasn't, until yesterday, been all that forward predominant in the debate about immigration reform. Here's a bit of what he had to say yesterday.
Now, this bill isn't perfect. It's a compromise. And going forward, nobody's going to get everything that they want. Not Democrats, not Republicans, not me. But this is a bill that's largely consistent with the principles that I and the people on this stage have laid out for common sense reform.
Common sense reform used to be called comprehensive reform. Frank Sherry is executive director of America's Voice. That's an immigration advocacy organization. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Should the president be more involved in this?
I think he's playing it just right. I mean, I think if he got too engaged, too involved, it would scare off the Republicans that are so critical to making this bipartisan bill move forward. So he's using the bully pulpit, but he's not spooking Republicans. And so I actually think I've been rather critical of him in recent years on immigration, but I think his strategy on this legislation has been just right.
Do you think this bill is the best that can be gotten so far, pending amendments, obviously, or does it not go far enough?
I guess I'll be the optimist in the group. I think this is the best policy proposal we've seen. on immigration reform of all the proposals over the last 20 years, and I think it has a really good chance of working. Obviously, it's not going to be perfect when it's implemented, but the idea of combining strong border security with an employment verification system that's mandatory, electronically verified in a way that will reduce the magnet of hiring, plus new visas so people can get in line and come legally rather than come with a smuggler and be subjected to exploitation, and a clean-the-slate legalization program that gives people a citizenship option. That combination is how you have you take a system that right now is a poorly enforced immigration system because they don't have the architecture of a 21st century approach. I think we have a good chance of reducing illegal immigration to a trickle. I think we have a very good chance of having an immigration system that makes us proud rather than makes us sick.
Earlier, Ruben Navarrete, our other guest, said that he thinks that this won't apply, because there's so many conditions in it, to all of the 11 or 12 or whatever the total is, a million of people who are undocumented in this country, but probably only to about 3 or 4 million. He called it half a loaf. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't agree with his assessment. I mean, not all 11 million people in the country without papers are going to be able to get on the path to citizenship. There's a cutoff date, for example, where you have to prove you're in the country from before December 31st, 2011. So right away, you're going to cut about 500,000 people who arrived after that, and they're not going to be eligible. And, of course, some people who have been involved in criminal activity, but they were never going to get legalized either. I think most of the 11 million, though, will be able to get on the path to legal status initially, and then hopefully will be able to stay on that path. And, of course, they don't qualify for permanent residence until 10 years and citizenship 13 years. It's a very long, arduous path. But honestly, undocumented immigrants are following this debate with a great deal of interest because this is their chance to be formally recognized, legally authorized to work, be able to travel to their home country, and eventually be able to settle here permanently. And that is what 11 million people are hoping for.
Let me go back to Doris Meisner at the Migration Policy Institute, formerly commissioner of the INS, now called the ICE. What do you think about the number of people who will ultimately, after 13 or 15 years, be able to attain citizenship if this bill is passed? Will it be that high? Will it be as comprehensive as is claimed?
I don't think we know how high it will be that far out into the future. There are lots of things that can happen or need to fall in place. But I agree that at the outset, which is the most important step, most of the 11 million will be able to qualify, because the way that this bill is set up, the first step is a pretty straightforward, relatively simple registration procedure. It's coming forward, it's giving the government fingerprints so that there can be a full background check to determine any criminal record. Most of these people will pass that, and then they will be what's called registered provisional immigrants, and they will have a very, very important new set of rights, which are the right to work legally in the United States and the right to travel to and from the United States. That means that they'll be eligible to get driver's licenses in the states that they live in. In most states, they'll be eligible to be residents for purposes of in-state tuition to go on to school. And that status lasts for 10 years, as Frank pointed out. That gives them a great deal of latitude that they don't have now. They will start to contribute through taxes and other better ways because they're on a solid footing in the United States. And some of them may not, at the end of 10 years, want to adjust to getting a green card. I think most of them will want to adjust to getting a green card because it's a far greater level of security, but they'll have a choice at that point. If they want to get a green card, they'll have to show that they are able to speak English and so forth. So it is a long and arduous path, but it is structured in a way that the incentives argue in favor at the front end of the largest possible number of people coming forward, and that's good policy.
Frank Sherry with America's Voice, Immigration Advocacy Group. There are Democrats who are opposed or reluctant to support this bill. It has divided both parties. Where do you see the Democrats that are opposed to it, and how do you think their votes might be won if amendments are passed?
Well, one of the most underreported aspects of this story is how Democrats have gone from being very divided to being mostly unified. There are 54 senators who caucus with the Democrats. And at this point, there's none who have come out against the bill. That's in stark contrast to just a few years ago where, something like 15 Democrats voted against the immigration bill on the Senate floor. So the elections had a big impact on Republicans who realized that they were on the wrong side of the fastest growing groups of new voters. It also had a big impact on Democrats who realized they have to deliver for Latinos and immigrant voters who have made such a difference in recent elections for them. So I think we'll probably lose a couple, maybe two or three Democrats at the most out of the 54. Ultimately, the real question is going to come down this year. Immigration reform is going to happen or not if enough Republicans decide that they want to put this issue behind them, do what's right for the country, and rehabilitate their brand with Latino voters. If they don't, if they block reform, I think they're going to deepen the problem that they've had politically, and the GOP is going to have a difficult time winning national elections going forward.
Jerry Kammer, back to you at the Center for Immigration Studies. What about the House? And aren't there Republicans and Democrats in the House that have a lot of trouble with immigration reform?
The House is where I think the real interesting action is going to be. I don't think there's much doubt that there will be a healthy vote to approve this legislation out of the Senate. And then when it goes into the House, there are all sorts of variables at work. There's the chairman of Judiciary Committee, Congressman Goodlatte, and most important, there's Mr. Boehner and what decision he will make as to how the bill will be brought up, under what circumstances, and whether it will happen in a piecemeal fashion or in a unitary fashion. That's going to be really fascinating to watch.
Mr. Boehner, the Speaker, of course, of the House of Representatives. Ruben Navarrete, there are Republicans, particularly those in certain districts that don't have a lot of Latino voters, who are saying that this is really just an effort by Democrats to get more votes for themselves, and consequently they can oppose it on that ground. What do you think is the future of this bill in the House?
Well, to get back to your earlier point, as a way of addressing that question, I think Frank is overselling the idea that this is going to be cruised by with Democrats. You've got Tester against it, Landrieu against it, Pryor's against it. Sherrod Brown in Ohio, a heavy union state, probably may come out against it, hasn't been obviously said a word about it. I don't think he's going to lose two or three Democrats. I think at the end of the day, you'll probably lose six or seven Democrats. That means you'll have to find six or seven Republicans and then some to make up the difference. And so the end game that you mentioned about the Republicans is clearly Republicans are trying to put off the inevitable. They know they can't afford to be slapped with the label of being anti-Hispanic. They read demographic trends just like everybody else. But at the end of the day, they have to go back to their constituents, and their constituents don't like the idea of allowing people who are here illegally to stay here legally. So they're really caught in a difficult position. But the whole point is, so are Democrats. If we're honest about this, the Democratic Party likewise has to struggle between placating union members who are uneasy about the bill. I'm not talking about the leaders of the unions, but the rank and file who are uneasy.
AFL-CIO leader was standing next to the president yesterday. Go ahead.
Yeah, the leaders say one thing, and the rank and file go in a different direction. We learned that in the 80s when the rank and file voted for Reagan, despite the fact that the leaders came out against him. So the rank and file union members, the carpenters unions and the plumbers and the electricians and the like, the tradesmen, they don't like this idea. And so the Democrats have to worry about making Latinos happy on the one hand without ticking off the union members on the other.
Okay. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for this conversation. But thank you very much. We've gotten a good preview, I think, of what is in store. The debate will be going on in the Senate at least until the 4th of July. It'll be over by then if Harry Reid has his way. We'll see what happens then in the event that it passes in the House. Ruben Navarrete, Jr., Washington Post Writers Group, CNN contributor, Jerry Kammer with the Center for Immigration Studies, Doris Meisner with the Migration Policy Institute, former commissioner of the Immigration Service, Frank Sherry with America's Voice and our earlier guest, Fawn Johnson, who covers immigration for the National Journal. Thank you very much, all of you, for being on our program. Last night, riot police drove protesters from Taksim Square in central Istanbul, which has been the scene of increasingly violent confrontations. Prime Minister Recep Erdogan and demonstrators have been having a conversation today. We're going to try to see if we can find out what the situation is there at the moment in just a moment after we take a very brief break on To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Well, and I'll be back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. I just want to read a few tweets from Istanbul and Taksim Square from last night. Not just young spoiling for a fight, but also their parents with goggles and masks, hearing constant explosions and sirens, excessive police brutality. I was hit in the chest with a tear gas canister, others worse. Those tweets are from last night, once again, from Scott Peterson, who is based in Istanbul for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joins us now. Scott Peterson, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What's going on in Taksim Square, as far as you can tell, at the moment?
Well, we've been hearing quite a bit of chanting that's been going on, the banging of pots and pans. It's just in the past hour or so. And we've also been getting just the first amounts of information coming from a four-hour-long meeting that the prime minister had with some of the Occupy Gezi people who wanted to stop that redevelopment project of that park. And it sounds like they will be asked to leave immediately. I'm not sure what that's going to yield or what the circumstances are. If the people in the park decide that they don't want to leave, then we could see one more night of clashes. But I think it's not yet clear whether that's preordained or not.
Other spokespeople from the administration seem to be taking a softer tone than Prime Minister Erdogan.
Well, they have. I mean, in some respects, certainly early on in this crisis, almost 2 weeks ago now, we were looking at kind of a good cop, bad cop scenario. But of course, you know, even when you had the deputy prime minister and you had President Abdullah Gül saying things like, well, you know, we understand that these protesters have some legitimate grievances and we apologize for the heavy use of, you know, of by the police of tear gas in the early stages and that sort of thing. You know, what was clear to all of us who've been watching Turkish politics for a long time is that, you know, those aren't the words of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He's the one who's really kind of authoritarian bent in the view of those who are in the parks and those who are protesting, you know, is really at issue here. And he's the one who has really demonstrated so far very, very little willingness to compromise on these issues. I mean, today this is the first thing in almost 2 weeks that we've had where he has actually sat down and spoken with some people from this protest group, and that's kind of the first sign of compromise that's come. Instead of that, most of what we've heard from him in repeated speeches is really a dismissing of these people as you know, really being politically nobody and vandals and marauders, and using quite dismissive language that has made them all the angrier.
He, of course, has been elected and re-elected. Many people say that he'd be re-elected again if he were to run today. Does this, do you think, suggest that maybe his sense of confidence is beginning to erode a bit as this goes on?
Well, I think that, you know, what he really focuses on, the term that people use, is this majoritarian democracy, that he believes that because his party has, as you mentioned, has in each of successive elections gain more popularity, and in the most recent one had almost half of the electorate, it means that he feels that he and his party can make the decisions for everybody else. Now, of course, there's the other half of the electorate that didn't vote for him. Those are some of the people who feel that they are not represented, who are coming out insisting that the decisions be made in a more collaborative way, that there be a more inclusive means of democracy going on here. But again, that has not been Prime Minister Erdogan's style. It never has been. He's always been a defiant and uncompromising character. It's one of the things that does endear him, of course, to his supporters. And he's been receiving all sorts of counter advice during these clashes by telling people, you know, you've really just got to go in there and advising Erdogan to just go in there and flatten the place, because we can't, you know, there's no room in Turkey for these kind of people.
Remind our listeners, it's a parliamentary system, so when you get almost 50%, that is a substantial number. To what extent does this have to do with the prime minister's Islamism?
Well, I think there's also a heavy degree of that as well, because, of course, many of the people who don't support him and who have been protesting are also people who are slightly more secular, or sometimes, in some cases, very fiercely secular, and they've taken issue with a number of Islam-leaning rules. I mean, one, for example, have been new restrictions that have been placed on alcohol sales and displays, which have come new. And in a place like Istanbul, that really does make a difference, because you've got a lot. I mean, there's a lot of alcohol that's available here. Turks drink it, tourists drink it, and so that really does change and can change the complexion of things a bit. But that's just one example. There are a number of others that have caused people, you know, where basically Erdogan and the ruling party have stepped into these kind of broader social debates and begun to insist on lifestyle changes and that sort of thing in the Islamic way, and they're very, very much responding and reacting to that in a negative way. And that's one of the reasons we've seen so much anger on the streets.
So as for the immediate situation, then, the bottom line seems to be that the prime minister has said these people have got to get out of there and get out of there now. So there could be more confrontations as the night goes on.
Well, what we don't know is what was agreed between both sides. So I'm not sure yet whether this is an order or it's an agreed kind of de-escalation, or if there's going to be a referendum on what will happen to that park. I've seen some references to that yet. It's only just been the last few minutes that meeting has really ended. So it's not quite yet clear, I think, what is going to transpire. But it could certainly be more violence. There are a lot of people in the square right now, and this is the normal time when things kick off. So,
all right. Scott Peterson speaking to us from Istanbul in the evening there, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Many thanks for being with us. Our program produced today by Caitlin Schamberg, with Evan George and Katie Cooper. Technical Director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point from PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.